behind themselves, behind the trees and the rocks. Even the trees and the rocks behind the Jews. And the trees and the rocks would say, Ya Abdullah, O servant of Allah, come, there is a Jew behind me, kill him.
وارض غدت برجالها مسيوجة
مسيوجة
لهل العدا سم وطريق اللاوي ولهل الهدى واد وساعد جوجة مرقى براسه والشرف متساوي واسمعهم
This is Radio Jihad. Radio Jihad. Radio Jihad. Radio Jihad. Global Security Matters.
Good evening. It is Friday, September the 2nd, 2011. Now, I hope that I'm not coming across as being too distorted in my voice. It seems there's a bit of feedback happening, but this is Global Security Matters, and with me is my co-host, Reese Cup. You want to say hello, Reese?
Hello, Reese.
Right. Okay. Now, later on in the show, we're going to be having a guest, Gary H. Johnson Jr. of the Tea Party Tribune, who also has written for Family Security Matters, and also he used to be on Wednesdays, he used to have his own show on the Radio Jihad Network called The Elemental Struggle. Now he has his own show, normally three times a week, on the Tea Party Tribune and the United West. So we're going to have Gary on a little bit later. We're going to be discussing a document that I mentioned last week. Last week I mentioned that this document called Fear Inc. had just come out. Now, this was written by the Center for Security Policy, and it was about 160 pages long and written by several people. And I hadn't had time to do more than just a very brief scan of reviews and downloading it and having a very, very quick look through that. Since then, I've absorbed quite a lot of it. I've written one article about it. I'm going to be writing another one. Gary has been blogging about it pretty much solidly on the Tea Party Tribune yesterday and today, so people can have a look on the Tea Party Tribune on his section called The Bunker, because he's elevating himself, he's doing very well over there, writing a lot about foreign policy issues. But on his little section, a blog called The Bunker, which is on the Tea Party Tribune, he's been for 2 days solid discussing everything that he can find about this particular document. And that's something that, you know, we will be discussing later when he comes on. So, right, now, there hasn't been an awful lot of new news. We've had pretty much extensions of the same old stuff with Libya. What, about a week and a half ago, people were saying was going to be the final showdown, that there was going to be a new government coming into power. That still hasn't happened. I mean, even though the West is now recognizing the transitional government, the one that's led by Mustafa Abdul Jalil, but still, because Gaddafi has not surrendered, some of his family members have fled to Algeria, and one of his wives has fled to Algeria with a daughter. Some of his sons have also gone to Algeria. Nobody is fully aware of where Gaddafi is. They think he's in Sirte, which is in the center on the coast, on the Mediterranean coast of Libya. between Benghazi and Tripoli. Benghazi in the east is the main center where the so-called rebels are based, and Tripoli is where the traditional capital of Libya has been. And I want to, at some stage, I mean, I would like to actually discuss some of the issues of Libya's history, because, I mean, people talk about democracy in Libya as if Libya used to have some great Western-style government long before Gaddafi came to power in 1969. This is totally untrue. There has only ever been, for Libya, one national election. And that national election took place in 1951. Now, people, there was a green flag when Gaddafi was the leader. Most of the people now have a green, white, and blue, I think it's green, white, and blue flag, which has a picture of an Islamic crescent and a star, because this was the flag that was put in place in 1951 when Libya became an independent nation. It was set up as a kingdom, and under a king called King Idris, Libya came into being. And King Idris, he was from the family of a man called Sanusi. Now, the Grand Sanusi, he was sometimes called. This was an individual who was alive in the 19th century, who was a Salafist, a reformist in Islam. Now, round about the beginning of the 19th century, for a long time, Italy was in control of Libya. And the ideas of this Sanusi guy, who is the ancestor of King Idris, these are very, very close to Egyptian Islamist ideologies, which is why it's quite worrying parallels. Soon as with the Arab Spring, when you had in Tahrir Square, the Liberation Square in Cairo, as soon as you had the Western media and Western governments, like Obama, throwing Mubarak under the bus, even though Mubarak had been stern, but a Western ally, and an ally of Israel as well. Once America and the West decided to give their support to the revolution in Egypt, all of a sudden, everything in the Middle East has changed. The idea of Egypt and Israel being at peace has gone out of the window entirely. No matter who gets into power, the military, the Islamists are going to be pretty much opposed to having Israel. Another development today, which I also want to discuss in the show, is Turkey has now expelled the Israeli ambassador from Ankara, which is, you know, the capital of Turkey. And this is all on account of what happened last year with the flotilla. The flotilla was when about seven boats, most notably the one called the Mavi Marmara, which had set off, most of them from Turkey, with the red flag with the white crescent and star, the Turkish flag flying on the sides of them. And these boats were carrying people. I was going to say, you know, so-called people, but they were people, more or less, including a whole load of whining leftists, to go and break Israel's blockade of Gaza. Now, according to the United Nations has admitted that Israel was perfectly within its right to have a blockade around Gaza because, obviously, with Hamas in charge and Hamas's charter saying that they will not rest until Israel is destroyed and the Jews are removed from that region, obviously, Gaza, which has a strip of coastline, is potentially very dangerous. It is now even more dangerous than it has ever been. There is a corridor now with Sinai region has now opened up between Egypt and Gaza, and already there are arms being smuggled in, and the situation for Israel is going to get very, very dire. But why I was mentioning this parallel with... I'll discuss Turkey in a minute, but this parallel of Libya, where the West suddenly gets on board with the so-called rebels, it is not going to end well. You know, a week and a half ago, there was jubilation. There were people demonstrating, fireworks being let off. The idea then was that everybody was going to celebrate because Gaddafi was going to surrender. It was reported that two of his sons had been captured. And Muhammad, I believe, was one. And Saif al-Islam, the one who had been educated at the London School of Economics, very urbane, very articulate, quite westernized individual, was said to have surrendered, and his brother had been arrested. His brother had escaped by the morning of Tuesday last week, and Saif al-Islam had also basically not been under arrest at all. Nobody knows where Gaddafi is. They think he's at Sirte. And so Sirte is now being attacked, even though nobody actually knows whether they're protecting Gaddafi or not. So you have the so-called rebels, the ones who are legitimized and supported by NATO and the Arab League, are attacking a town because they believe that it has a dictator hidden somewhere. This does not bode well for the future. It does not bode well at all. You know, if there is Gaddafi there, then surely they should be able, if they really are a legitimate government in waiting, they should be able to send diplomats in there to find out if there's any way of negotiating a surrender or negotiating an exit for Gaddafi so he can save face. It is all becoming very, very dire in Libya at the moment. Now, the other thing that I was saying about Turkey. Now, when Turkey allowed, there was a group called IHH, which is an Islamist group based in Turkey, which has links to the Union of Good. It also has links to, there was a man called Mohammad Reza who tried to be involved in the bomb plot of the Millennium bomb plot of the LAX Los Angeles airport. And he was this man who was, I believe, of Algerian origin, had been arrested. But this group called IHH, the charity which had put in place the Mavi Marmara ship and a few other ships, which took part in the convoy to Gaza to break the blockade on May the 31st last year. That was when, in the early hours of the morning, Israeli commandos boarded the ship. Then they were attacked with iron bars and 9 people got killed. And because of that, because Israel has not apologized for this, Turkey has now decided to sever its diplomatic relations with Israel on the condition that they will only improve if Israel shows signs of contrition. This is a very, very dangerous move. We already have Turkey is starting to play a role with the opposition inside Syria. Now, you've got two groups of Shia people. Now, Assad in Syria, he's of the Alawis, and It's a minority group, only comprising 10 to 15% of the Syrian population. Similarly, you've got the Alevis, who are also of the same origin, who are in Turkey. But these people are very, very different indeed. In Turkey, the Alevis, they are Shia, but they're quite liberated. They are allowed, the women are allowed to worship with the men. Nobody's expected to wear headscarves. The women are encouraged to become educated, to get jobs, and to take part in what had been the great secular dream of Turkey. But since Recep Tayyip Erdogan, spelt E-R-D-O-G-A-N, but pronounced Erdogan, because it's got a funny cedilla, it's not a cedilla, but it's got a... what you have on España, you know, it has this straight, the G has a weird Turkish accent on top of it, which means it's pronounced W, so it's Erdogan. Now, Erdogan, he is an Islamist. He was jailed at one stage for reciting a poem that spoke about our mosques will be our... What was it? The minarets will be our rockets, and our mosques, the domes of our mosques, will be our battalions. It was basically talking about Islamism should be the norm for Turkey. Turkey is already a member of NATO, but because Turkey is never going to join the European Union, it seems, under this current government, they cannot accept Cyprus as an independent nation. Turkey invaded Cyprus about 30 years ago, or more than 30 years ago, and since then, Cyprus is a divided island, and Turkey will not recognize Cypriot legitimacy. They believe that the whole island should be under Turkish control. There have been some pretty horrific things in Turkey's history. Turkey still refuses to acknowledge its part in the Armenian genocide. It also refuses to acknowledge its part in, at the time, the Armenian genocide got to its peak in 1915 and had started off really in the 1880s. There was a man called Abdulhamid II, who was the Sultan of the Ottoman Sultan, who was pretty repressive, and then you had the Young Turks came into power in 1909, and they started enacting, following on from Abdulhamid and his repression of Armenian Christians, and finally in 1915, when the world was engaged in a world war, the Ottoman Empire had sided with the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and it had packed the wrong side and was losing. But in 1915, there was a mass deportation of Armenians, and these Armenians were forced to walk, and they were starved out. Women, children were forced to make long marches, and millions died. But you cannot mention that. Under the secular government of Kemal Ataturk, which came into power in 1923, and which on the 3rd of March 1924 dissolved the Ottoman Caliphate altogether, that government refused to acknowledge that any massacre of Armenians has taken place, and even under the Islamist government of Erdogan, they still won't acknowledge it. But the reason why I'm bringing these things in is because Turkey has, since the time of Ataturk, Kemal Ataturk had been a soldier who had then, with his wife, he had managed to throw away everything that the Ottomans had kept, which is Arabic, for example, Arabic script, women forced to wear headscarves and things like that. Kemal Ataturk was very much a modern character. In fact, he was so modern he died of liver failure from drinking too much alcohol. And the problem with Turkey nowadays is that the secular dream that Kemal Ataturk had put into place had meant that whenever there was an Islamist government, the army would have a coup and would get rid of them. What has been very, very snide on the part of Recep Tayyip Erdogan and Abdullah Gül, who is now the president, now they belong to the AKP, the Freedom and Justice Party. Now, officially, you cannot wear headscarves, but Abdullah Gül and Erdogan, their wives, and all the members of their party, they all wear headscarves openly, even, you know, though they're not allowed to wear them inside government buildings. And they are using Turkey's desire to join the EU, the European Union, as a means of defanging the army. The army would be quite happy to have, or at least the army would have been very happy to have had Turkey being part of the European Union. It is already a part of the NATO alliance. But since Erdogan took power, in November 2005, he gave an ultimatum to the European Union. Either we have accession talks or we walk out. Now, he's still in power 6 years on, and the situation in Turkey is such now that recently it was reported about a year and a half ago that Erdogan's next election campaign, Iran, would be underwriting it. Iran has influence in Syria through Assad, Bashar al-Assad, the president of Syria, and the Hezbollah movement are active within Syria, who are funded by Iran again. Now, with Turkey moving away from Western secularism, Erdogan very craftily defanged the army. The army in Turkey have had several coups. 1971, there was one that I remember when I was, you know, a teenage kid. And as soon as a potentially Islamist government uses the democratic process to get into power in Turkey, the army would hold a coup and revert everything back to secularism to uphold the values that Kemal Ataturk had introduced. He, as I said, he removed the Arabic alphabet. He removed a lot of the Ottoman Arabism that had been going on. Now, what Erdogan has done is very, very clever. He has manufactured claims that there are going to be coups by the army to then launch his own coups to have military leaders and generals who had been in power for years, who had been trusted and reliable, having them jailed on trumped-up charges of trying to take over his government. There is an article of the Constitution of Turkey. It's Article 300, which is, you cannot insult Turkishness. And what is happening is, now, you have, I'm just getting a Skype message coming in, who's doing that? Oh, Holger on line three. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm just talking away, and I am so sorry, Holger. I didn't see you. Let's bring Holger in.
I was a young man when I called in.
I'm so sorry. I am so sorry. No, I was trying to find an article while I was talking, you know, which I wanted to. I wanted to get the name of the actual ambassador who was kicked out, the Israeli ambassador who was kicked out from Turkey. But sorry, I waffle.
Clinton was president when I called in.
Oh, sorry, Holger. I am sorry.
I think it was the ambassador was Gabby Levy. Is that right?
The Israeli ambassador, yes, I believe it is.
Okay.
It was in Ynet News today, anyway.
Yeah. I wanted to call because I had actually had gotten home from work and I'd seen this story up over at patdollar.com.
Right.
And I left a comment, and it's very, very brief, but all I said in comment to this whole action by Turkey is I said, okay, so now let the EU and America stop trade with Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
And kick Turkey's ass out of NATO.
Yeah.
And while we're at it, kill the mother effers Erdogan and Gül.
Yeah.
It was a little strong, but it pissed me off.
Right.
So I think, you know, I guess my point is we need to, I don't count on anything with this president that we've got right now, but I'm hoping that Turkey is feels the pain of a decision like this. And I'm not talking a pain directly from Israel. I'm talking the pain in their pocketbooks, the pain in diplomatic circles. I hope that they are severely reprimanded for this kind of baloney.
There is something that they did about a year ago, probably less than a year, which I thought was incredibly worrying. Now, I can't remember all of the names of the nations involved, but in Europe we have a thing called the Schengen Zone, which means that most nations in the European Union are party to an agreement where this thing called the Schengen Zone exists, where if you are, say, German, you can go into France without having to have, you know, full passports. All you need is just, you know, a little letter to say, you know, well, look, I live here. Now, what Turkey was trying to do was to, with four countries, including Libya and including Syria and Lebanon, and there was one other, they wanted to introduce, at least this was Erdogan, wanted to introduce a Schengen zone for Turkey with these Islamist countries. Now, what that could mean when Turkey, if it ever does become part of the European Union, would mean that we would have people moving into Turkey, being granted citizenship, and then being allowed to live anywhere in Europe, wherever they wanted. They're already in Germany and in Switzerland. Almost all of the Muslim migrants in those countries are from Turkey, as it is. And, I mean, I've got nothing against. I've been to Turkey. It's a beautiful place, and I knew people. I worked with people in London. One of them, a beautiful woman whose brother had been tortured to death by one of these army coups, which I was talking about. The army haven't always been good. And Nezahat, you know, this woman I used to know, she worked at an advice center, you know, where I also used to sort of work. You know, some of the stories coming out from there are quite horrific. But Erdogan, what he has been doing is pushing, using this desire that a lot of Western leaders had for Turkey as a NATO member to become part of the European Union. He's been holding that over people's heads, which has stopped the army from trying to bring a coup against him. Once he had his power established, he's defanged the army entirely to replace all of the generals with Islamist generals, and he's moving his focus of interest further towards the Iran-Syria nexus, which I think is very, very bad news for Israel.
Well, and I think if there's one positive thing,
mm-hmm.
it's that Turkey's military, I would say, in the past has been, you know, fairly decent, fairly formidable, fairly decent military. And as long as the Islamists are taking that over and integrating their Islamist generals in and so forth, they'll have that so messed up. You know, in a couple of years, they'll basically have an army like Syria. And a lot of people won't have to worry as much about it.
They also have a lot of people from Syria who fled from the recent killings by Assad. Turkey is trying to present itself as the new power broker in the Middle East, because of its relationship with NATO, that gives it a sort of favored status. But basically, a lot of the opposition who have gone into Turkey from Syria, they opened the borders and allowed a whole load of them in, into eastern Turkey, are predominantly, a lot of these people are Sunni, and they are, even though Bashir al-Assad is a Shia, an Alawi, most of the Muslims in Syria are Sunni, and a lot of the ones are connected to the groups affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood, and I think that what's going to happen is they're going to try and mount a Sunni coup that's going to happen within Syria. But they are still, at the same time, they're a member of the Organization of Islamic Conference, which is now renamed itself the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, 57 Muslim nations. They are playing off at the moment between Iran and Syria and the rest of the Muslim world by making a strike against Israel, which is what they've done today by effectively, it is Gabby Levy, I did find the article as we were talking, you were right, Gabby Levy has been told to leave. Now, what they're doing, I believe, is actually making it really, really difficult for any... It's with the Muslim Brotherhood does it. In its manifesto called The Project, it says in Article 11 that one of the things it wants to do is to use the Palestine-Israeli issue as a touchstone to radicalize Muslims all around the world. Now Turkey, which had been an ally of Israel, is, after Egypt had gone, Israel's got virtually no Muslim allies left.
Yeah.
And with Turkey removing that last bridge, it is putting Israel into a very dangerous situation, and it is also doing it for a political reason within the Organization of Islamic Conference. It seems Turkey is starting to turn its back on the West.
Well, let me ask you this, Adrian.
Yeah, sure.
Do you... I'm not going to say it's true now because obviously things have been taking these horrible turns with Turkey and so forth. But let's just say, 2 years ago. Let's go back 2 years ago. At that point in time, would you agree that at that point in time, probably two of the most reasonable and secular Islamic countries would have been, number one would have been Turkey and number two would have been Egypt?
No. I would have thought, in terms of for Western interests, I think Egypt probably would have been, even though there were moves afoot. But you've got to remember that in April 7th, 2007, that you had Steny Hoyer had gone to Egypt. He had met with Mohammed Khatatni, who was the head of the Muslim Brotherhood parliamentary body. There were already moves by the Democrats. That was a couple of days either side of that, either before or after. That was when Nancy Pelosi was dancing around in a Syrian market wearing a Muslim headscarf.
Yeah.
This was within 2 days of each other. It was either, I think it was actually on April the 7th, Pelosi in 2007, Pelosi was in Damascus, and then 2 days later, Steny Hoyer was in Egypt talking to the leader of the parliamentary group of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. So I think already they were being undermined. But Turkey had long before, by 2005, Turkey's Islamic credentials under Erdogan were pretty much solid. It was in 2003 or 4 that Erdogan came into power, and it was in 2005 November he basically blackmailed the European Union, saying that if you don't agree to have accession talks, we are going to turn our back on Europe altogether. Now, trade-wise, it's great to have Turkey trading. You know, I mean, that's no problem. But with the European Union, it's becoming more and more, I don't know, like a United States of Europe, which I think is politically a really, really bad move. All you need is one member of that European Union to have a problem with another country, say if Russia invades Czechoslovakia again or something. All of the European countries then have to make war against that aggressor. You know, and I think having Turkey involved in that, when Turkey has been... See, I don't think Turkey was... Turkey stopped being secular within 2 years of Erdogan getting into power. It was in late 2005. See, when they won the election, at that time, Erdogan was actually in jail. And the person who took over the prime ministership or the premiership was Abdullah Gül. And at the beginning of 2006, he became the president. So if you're going back only 2 years to 2009, they'd already had these mass, these mass arrests of generals and armies and feeding false stories to the press. I mean, Erdogan, once he got into power, he has been ruling it. I mean, you know that famous saying that, I think it was Napoleon said, l'état, c'est moi, the state, it is me. Now, this Article 300 that I mentioned about Turkishness, insulting Turkishness, there was an artist had depicted a picture in 2005. There was a cartoon of Erdogan as a kitten with string all round it. And, you know, he'd been playing with a ball of wool and was in a total knot, you know, with all these bits of, you know, string and wool all around him. And there was an English artist did a picture of him as a dog dropping a turd onto a billiard table. And the guy was arrested, you know, and basically, you know, both people were arrested. The Turkish cartoonist who did the newspaper drawing of him as a cat wrapped up and being throttled by all the string that it had been playing with, they had both were threatened with being jailed under Article 300 of insulting Turkishness. All of a sudden, Erdogan became the symbol of Turkishness. Before that, it was insulting Kemal Atatürk would be insulting Turkishness. And you had writers like Orhan Pamuk, because he had mentioned, it was in his novel Snow, he had mentioned the Armenian genocide. He was being tried under Article 300 for insulting Turkish. You know, this time, it was very much about Turkish history. And all of a sudden, Erdogan presents himself as l'état, c'est moi. You know, I am Turkey.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very... And since then, that arrogance... fighting the European Union, fighting the Council of Europe. It's a bit confusing, but you've got two bodies. You've got the Strasbourg European Court of Human Rights. Now, that isn't part of the European Union, but that was something from the Council of Europe from 1950. Russia and Britain and most of the European countries agreed on this treaty that there would be certain standards of rights. And they signed the ENCHR, the ECHR, the European Commission on Human Rights, was signed in 1950, and this was the establishment of the Council of Europe. Now, Erdogan has been promoting cases of student girls who want to wear headscarves using the Strasbourg courts from the Council of Europe to make sure that people... are eroding the secular state. And because Europe, they're trying to get themselves to come into... I don't think Erdogan has any desire to really become part of Europe. He knows he's got a future within the Islamic world.
I think you're right, and I think it's. I mean, it's just, you know, I wanted to just call in because I just, you know, this is, I liked what you said about, you know, this is major stuff, and I think it's the timing is a bit coincidental with all the other stuff that we're, you know, is just kind of laying the framework for what Israel is going to be going through and stuff. But I got to run. Appreciate your let me make the call in.
I'm so sorry. I did get to you earlier.
I wasn't there that long. I'm giving you a bad time.
Yeah, well,
I was chatting with Reese anyway. So
that's good.
That's never a waste of time.
Chat. Exactly. Yeah.
I agree. All right. See you, man.
Okay. Thanks, Olga.
You bet.
Bye. Right. I mean, anybody who wants to call in, please feel free. I mean, as I said, we're going to be having later in the show Gary H. Johnson Jr. As I mentioned at the very beginning, those of you who weren't around at the start, Gary H. Johnson on Wednesday night on the Radio Jihad Network used to have his show called The Elemental Struggle. He's written with me articles for Family Security Matters, and he also now has a spot with the Tea Party Tribune. He's doing very well for himself there. He's got his own little blog called The Bunker, and he's also a senior foreign policy advisor there. And he's going to be coming onto the show a little bit later, and we're going to be discussing what I mentioned last week was the Center for American Progress had last week, it was just published last Friday, a document called Fear Inc., all about Islamophobia and about how a few nasty people are behind all of the Islamophobia network. And what is really worrying is that they had said, the authors of this report a week ago were saying they were hoping it was going to go viral, and unfortunately, it already has. Now, the weekly Zaman, this is a, today's Zaman, you know, it is a Turkish newspaper, and there's an article on there today in the English version, talking exactly about this Islam's enemy network, it's called here in the article. I'm just going to read out a little bit from it, just to show how it isn't something that's just affecting America. It's being picked up by people in the Muslim world. Now, let me just find something that's sort of fairly relevant. The result of the fastidious... I'm just reading now from this article from this Turkish newspaper. The result of a fastidious six-month study, the report started by pointing out the ties between the extreme right-wing supporter Anders Breivik, who went on a killing spree that shocked the world, that was in July the 22nd, and those who spread hatred against Islam in the United States. In the manifesto, this is Breivik's manifesto, that he wrote about why he committed the massacre, Breivik mentioned Robert Spencer, who is known for spreading disinformation and hatred against Islam with his blog Jihad Watch, 162 times. Now, this is total bullcrap. Anybody, you know, I've unfortunately had to read the entire 1,500-page manifesto. And where Robert Spencer and other people are mentioned, almost exclusively, they are not mentioned by Anders Breivik. Anders Breivik has taken the writings of a man called Fjordman, who, as I said about 3 weeks ago, he has had his identity exposed. I'm not going to repeat his name again here. I think, you know, he's gone through enough. But Fjordman's articles quote, and they make references to the people that he's got his information from. And Robert Spencer's Jihad Watch, and also he had Dimmy Watch. I don't know if Dimmy Watch is still going. Had been a digest of news items which had been in the news at the time, and at no stage could I see Breivik ever mentioning Robert Spencer. It was just within the footnotes of Fjordman's articles, where Fjordman was referring to an event which Robert Spencer had documented. So this whole thing, now this guy in Turkey is quoting this, this is a direct quote about Robert Spencer being linked, you know, 162 times in Breivik's manifesto. This is appalling. This is something where Spencer is being equated, demonized as somebody who has inspired Anders Breivik. Robert Spencer's Jihad Watch does not have very much editorial. It's mostly linking. It has a small bit of editorial and it links to an article in the mainstream media from around the world about jihadism, which is really going on, Islamic terrorism, Islamic usurpation of democratic societies, and factual material. But what the authors of this study have done is to totally demonize and twist and turn things on its head. These are having an agenda. It's funded by George Soros, you know, the Center for American Progress. And George Soros, I don't know what is wrong with him. Either it's some psychiatric thing, or maybe it's his guilt because when he was a Jewish teenager, he was apparently running around with Nazis. I don't know what it is about George Soros, about how he can fund groups which have no moral integrity whatsoever. Now, it is very, very disturbing to read a report that apparently they say has taken 6 months of research to be brought into the light. And yet, for the bits which are making it into the media around the world are these false information, the talking about how Spencer is spreading disinformation and hatred against Islam, and spreading their own disinformation and their own hatred. And it is really, I mean, I'm going to wait until, I mean, I hope Gary is going to come back on. I mean, if he's not on within the next quarter of an hour, 20 minutes, I did tell him not to come in the first half an hour to an hour. I will be playing an interview which Wajahat Ali gave to Al Jazeera, where he briefly described the motives and the intentions of his report. Now, I mean, just going back to this this report from the Today's Zaman, which is a Turkish newspaper. Robert Spencer, who is known for spreading information, disinformation and hatred against Islam with his blog Jihad Watch. It also says he referenced political activist Pamela Geller and conservative writer and policy advocate David Horowitz 12 times. This was not Anders Behring Breivik mentioning them. This was Fjordman, who had mentioned them in his work. And for this to be the crux, they say that this report took 6 months to get together. If so, why have they focused at the very beginning of the report on this very recent event from July the 22nd, Friday July the 22nd, when Anders Behring Breivik set off a bomb in the political quarter of Oslo and then drove to the shore of a lake just south of Oslo, dressed up in his police uniform with his guns, got in a boat and got himself off to Utøya Island, where there was a Labour Party young people's conference going on, and then started to shoot people. In total, he killed 76 people on that day. Now, if this had not happened, it would not have the emotive kick that these callous individuals who are behind this Fear Inc. Islamophobia document, they would not be using it. This is something very, very twisted and manipulative, and it is treating American people like they are damned idiots. What went on in Norway, in the mind of a lunatic mass murderer, who has shown no remorse whatsoever, and he didn't go around killing Muslims, he went around killing Norwegian young civilians, it has nothing to do with what is going on in America. Another point, and in the article I published yesterday on family security matters, was everything that these people in the Center for American Progress are getting so upset about is that over a decade, five individuals who have various organizations were in receipt of $46 million over 10 years. In 1 year alone, the Center for American Progress receives $25 million for one organization. So if we look at it, in 2 years of the Center for American Progress being in existence, it will receive more money than the entire five organizations that it is claiming are making so much money, more money than they have made collectively over an entire 10-year period. There is no logic in this. This is propaganda at its cheapest and at its dirtiest. And what it's basically trying to say is that Islamophobia is being manufactured by evil right-wing conservative Americans who don't like Muslims. It's not about they don't like Islam, and why should you like Islam? I'm sorry. It's everybody's right to like or dislike any ideology or religion that they choose. If you don't have that freedom, you don't have a democracy. And if you think that Islam has enough verses in it to make sure that we've had 18,000 terrorist attacks since 9/11, which have gone on around the world, the vast majority of terrorism for ideological purposes nowadays is Islamist. Now, those acts of terrorism, those weren't brought into being because of a few Islamophobic individuals. This is dishonesty on the grandest scale possible. And this is what I am so damned angry about, is that honesty and facts and objectivity, if you are a journalist, you are meant to be objective. This isn't about being objective right from the get-go. It is saying that people like Robert Spencer are anti-Muslim. Now, that is a lie. And there is no evidence to say that Robert Spencer is against Muslims as people. I am getting another little message. I think there's somebody in the... I've got to stop ranting. Gary's in the queue. Oh my gosh, Mr. Johnson is in the house. Now I've lost my... I can't get into the switchboard because I've hidden it. Oh my god, Gary, you're locked out. I found it.
I found him. He's in.
I'm in?
Oh, let's kick him out again. Come on, go away,
okay.
Gary. Go away.
Oh, that's okay. I was a little bit tied up eating an ice cream sundae, so... It was good just to hear you. I was having a good time with it. You were doing a great job, man. I don't know.
I was ranting. I haven't had my music break yet. So I'm going to give you 5 minutes, and I'm going to have a music break, okay?
Okay.
And then you can come back, and you can rant to your heart's content. So let's have it, Gary. Have you digested your Sunday?
I definitely have. It was awesome.
Okay. And you're ready.
It was the last of the vanilla ice cream, though, so I'm upset about that. But other than that, I'm good. For everybody to know, I don't know if everybody's been paying attention to this Fear Inc. thing, but you know, I've looked into it a little bit more than most people. I think I've gone ahead and started over at the bunker at the Tea Party Tribune. I went ahead and started doing a little bit of live blogging. It's actually fun. I don't know if anybody else has tried to do live blogging before, but just all you do is just continually write whenever you find new information. And I've been trying to do live blogging, but I wanted to put it in the form that people could understand it. So what I do is I try to make an update every hour or so over the course of 4 or 5 hours worth of live blogging. And what I've done as far as this Fear Inc. is concerned is I've gone back 6 months, and I've started to look to see what the Center for American Progress was doing 6 months ago.
Because that was the time when they officially started to research this piece. At least if you believe, and I'm finding whatever Wajahat Ali, who is the main researcher, author, says, I'm finding it increasingly hard to take anything he says as being honest truth. But it was 6 months ago, that was when this report started to be researched.
Well, the thing that's going on is everybody has a problem on the left defeating the arguments that are being made by Frank Gaffney and David Yerushalmi, particularly. They all have a beef against, you know, Pamela Geller. You know, they think all the left wing, you know, they think she's a little bit of a harpy, and they don't like the way, you know, she's been pushing this situation at the Ground Zero Mosque and stuff like
Some
that.
Some of the people on the right feel that way about her too, but I mean, we'll carry on. Yeah.
I'm going to let it go. But basically, whenever I was looking into this, I went back 6 months and I was like, okay, well, the report was released at the end of July, you know, the beginning of August. So I pretty much went back to...
No, it was actually released last week officially. That was the date
that's what I meant.
Of publication.
The end of August, the beginning of September, excuse me.
Yeah.
And basically, I went back 6 months, and that pretty much put me into the end of February, beginning of March area. And lo and behold, you know, back at the six-month mark, I started looking at to see what the left wing was talking about with Yerushalmi. And an article had been released by a guy named Tim Murphy over at a place called Mother Jones.
Yes.
And I understand it's hard to digest sometimes, but Mother Jones is a left-wing, you know, a bi-monthly publication. They pretty much take whatever the left-wing think tanks give them as far as scholars are concerned. And the point
are you
of the
saying
article,
that Tim Murphy takes things? No, sorry, no. You carry on, Karen. Sorry.
The point of the article was that Yerushalmi was actually a white supremacist, and that he hated black people. They took a little essay that he wrote back in 2006 on the SANE network, discussing the nature of race, and they took a number of his statements out of context, and they basically stated that everything that he says is from the voice of a white supremacist. And I didn't know Hasidic Jews could be white supremacists, but apparently it's possible, you know, as far as the left wing is concerned.
Can I just cut in there on you now, because I remember when that was happening. Now, what had actually made that very interesting? I mean, not very interesting. I mean, I thought it was actually quite horrific. I mean, because Alyssa A. Lappin, you know, she writes for us, very nice woman. She was furious at what was going on, the way that David Yerushalmi was being slandered and libeled in that way. But what had got Alyssa's goat got her really angry was the way that Abraham Foxman of the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, was also repeating the same thing. Now, you know, you're saying this was 6 months ago, this was in February, at exactly the same time as Yerushalmi was being demonized, not just in Mother Jones, but also he was being demonized by Abraham Foxman in the ADL. And at the very same time, Pamela Geller and Robert Spencer were also being demonized. You know, this,
right.
Which is very, very interesting. This was, you know, the same time, round about February. The ADL had done a volte-face, you know, totally changed direction.
Yeah, and that's pretty much what I've discussed at the bunker at my first live blog about it. It apparently, by the 25th of March, the ADL came out and put their article about Yerushalmi out, and they also had put one out at that point about Robert Spencer, Pamela Geller, and the SIOA. And there had been, you know, a huge pivot in the way the ADL viewed the anti-Sharia movement. So something happened probably between January and March at the ADL with Foxman. Either there was some new funding that came in, maybe from a left-wing Soros-type mm-hmm. financier or something yep. along those lines. We're still trying to figure it out. It's hard to go into the ADL because there's so many different organizations that are linked to it. So
J Street is being funded by Soros. I mean, that's one Jewish organization which is very much left wing. It's virtually anti-Israeli.
Well, I mean, you used to have AIPAC and ADL,
right?
And the ADL was with AIPAC, and they were relatively pro-Zion, and they were relatively anti-Sharia, but they were always pro-freedom of religion, and we were fine with that. And then you had the ADL and the J Street group on the left. And when I say ADL, I'm talking about the Arab Defense League
right.
and J Street, which were completely against the anti-Sharia movement and stuff like that. So there's two ADLs out there. And the Anti-Defamation League was always going against the Arab Defense League is what it used to be. That was the formula. Mm-hmm. And now it appears as though the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, has slipped into the dark side of the Soros grasp. You know, the Sith Lord has spoken, apparently, of somehow. And I'm trying to track that down personally. But after I looked at that's how it all began. You know, I was starting to look into it. But the reason that the process started was because of the Oklahoma law that changed, that basically stated in the courts of the state that there was not going to be any Sharia law allowed. That law was kicked out by an activist federal judge. And then because of that, the entire program for the American laws for American courts began pushing across the country a new version which
yeah.
took out the word Sharia law and changed it to foreign law.
Yes.
And that process has pushed across 23 separate states and has started to be voted on. A number of different states have been pushing it. Tennessee was the main starting point, I think, and then it just
spread. Yeah, and then South Carolina is going through there as well. Yeah.
Right. So that was the target. They were trying to get to that. But the arguments that were being made at the same time Frank Gaffney was making these arguments of the necessity of this American Laws for American Courts, Yerushalmi was pushing the program, and at the same time, he was pushing the lawsuit against AIG and against the Fed in the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. So what I looked at was the main nexus point that they were trying to attack was Yerushalmi, because he was supporting both the AIG case, and he was the one responsible for the I guess you'd call it the verbiage of the American Laws for American Court process. So at the end of March, at that point, Center for American Progress comes out, and Wajahat Ali and Matthew Duss release a report called Understanding Sharia Law. And in a 6-page document, they literally destroy, in their opinion, the validity and the credibility of all of the different people who are in the anti-Sharia movement.
Right. Now,
so that's
the thing
how this
is,
whole thing started.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. But, I mean, other things were happening as well in February. I mean, at that stage, they were doing a media thing against Melanie Phillips in Britain. You know, another person who was suddenly being demonized as a hater and a bigot because she was being effective. And the thing is, Yerushalmi was being effective, you know. But what annoys me, I mean, just to interject a little bit further as well, about Wajahat Ali, who's the main researcher and the main author of this thing. I mean, he uses this aspect of saying, oh, you're not qualified enough. He jumps on people and says that even Noni Darwish, an Egyptian, ex-Muslim, she doesn't have enough Islamic qualifications to know that Islam is bad, when she's lived on the receiving end of Islamic sexism and seeing it around her. And this is what really annoys me about the dishonesty. I mean, he says he's an attorney, and if he's an attorney, God knows how he ever wins cases, because he cannot talk straight. He sideballs, you know, he does curveballs, you know, nothing actually goes directly. This guy, Wajahat Ali, I would love to know his opinions of how the blasphemy laws in his native, where his family comes from, is all from Pakistan. I would love to know how they would think about how Sharia law really does nothing for Christians. It does nothing for Ahmadi Muslims. It does nothing for the minority Hindu communities in Pakistan, other than oppress them and make them into second-class citizens and open them up to violence and the likelihood of being jailed for blasphemy merely because they are not part and parcel of this Islamist Sharia enforcement. I mean, I just cannot see the logic of saying you've got to have a qualification. He damns Zudi Jasser and says that Zudi Jasser doesn't have an Islamic qualification. But does Wajahat Ali, does he have any Islamic qualifications? No, he has not.
Well, I looked into the fund, the Action Fund of Center for American Progress today, and
right.
I found a little discussion about how they work. And what they say is, basically, our methodology is to talk to experts and professionals and citizens in the field, and we come to a conclusion. And then once we come through a debate process and figure out what we really want to do, at that point we stand up and we act and we start the process of framing and shaping the debate on the national
right.
level.
That's fine, but if the people you're going to are going to spin you a load of takir and saying, oh, well, you know, I mean, I'm sorry, but, you know, he who kills one man is as if he's killed the whole world, you know, I mean,
What you were saying was, what are his qualifications? Well, his qualifications are that he's gone out and his six members of his team, or he and the other five
members,
and
they've
have
gone and spoken
out and
to somebody who's a self-appointed expert who says, I know all that there is to know, so if you listen to me, then you're suddenly an expert. That
right.
isn't having a qualification.
So the question that needs to be asked of
you've got to attribute. If they, sorry, I'm interrupting you, but, you know, they should attribute.
Yeah.
If they are going to go to some so-called expert, they should say, according to the opinion of Imam whatever, then this is wrong, or this. But there are so many conflicting views.
They attributed Mark Sageman.
Is Mark Sageman a Muslim?
I don't believe so, but they've apparently attributed everything to him as far as the discussion and the diatribe regarding the Anders Breivik discussion. You know, he's basically saying that the architecture of this echo chamber and extreme ideology of the left, of the conservative party, is what allowed Anders Breivik to surface. He is of that architecture. And whenever you're looking at that it just seems to me like Mark Sageman, who, by the
you're
way...
You're breaking up a little bit, Gary.
Okay, well, Mark's... Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay, well, Mark Sageman, I've read, you know, his book, his recent book. I forget the title. But whenever I was in the library, I decided to pick it up, and I got about halfway through, and I just couldn't read it. I mean, it was just full of charts and graphs that didn't make any sense, and, you know, the pictures of the areas as far as what he was trying to graph was totally out of whack. It didn't make any sense. And it seems to me like he's just a professor that is grandstanding and saying he's an expert.
Right.
But he is definitely of the left.
Okay. Now, Gary, would you mind if we had just a quick little 3-minute break for some music so I can go and have a comfort break?
Sure.
Right. In fact, we're going to... Sorry?
I'll stick around.
Good. Right, I'm going to play some nice Christian music, because we don't have enough Christian music recently, and I think this might be quite nice.
Thank you.
Okay, we don't need to hear all the applause. That was the Talis Singers singing Nunc Dimittis by Palestrina, who was a 17th century Italian composer. Okay, Gary, you're back on. This is the Radio Jihad Network Global Security Matters, and we are discussing the report by the Center for the Center for American Progress called Fear Inc., published last Friday and written by Wajahat Ali, Faiz Shakir, and a few other people from the Center for American Progress Action Fund. Okay, you were talking.
Wow, you say all that and you don't have anything scripted.
No.
That's awesome, man. I have to write stuff like that down. I have trouble, you know, keeping all the little details like that in my head. But basically, where we were, I was talking about the fact that Yerushalmi was the centerpiece and the force that they were trying to strike at.
Because single-handedly, he had been the main opponent of the Southern Poverty Law Center.
Yeah, he was the main opponent of the Southern Poverty Law Center. His work with the Thomas More Law Center pushed the case against Geithner all the way to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. It looks like it was going to the Supreme Court. And if you look at it, that's one of the reasons that Elena Kagan was probably nominated and pushed into the Supreme Court so that she could do a little bit of damage control for the Obama administration. But basically, what you have is a situation where Sharia law is being practiced in the United States at the court level, and it's being practiced at the state level as far as family law is concerned and as far as Islamic finance law is concerned.
Mm.
And all of these people who are on the Center for American Progress and the left, they're actually saying that there is no problem, there's no reason, because we have the Supremacy Clause, that we should worry about Sharia law creeping into our courts. But the fact is, in the American Bar Association, there is an Islamic Finance Committee. You know, I mean,
yes.
It's actually creeping into the system through the financial doors and through the family law doors. And most of the family law that's done is through pro bono work.
Yeah. I mean, they had an issue in 2005 where in Canada they were trying to vote. It was originally just in Ontario where they were trying to vote on getting in Sharia law for the family courts. And it was thrown out. But this woman, Marion Boyd, who had been behind it, I mean, eventually what they had to do was, in order to throw it out, they also had to remove Jewish negotiations and dealings with family matters, which was unfair because Jewish law doesn't discriminate in the way that Islam very specifically discriminates against women. Women are allowed to have children up until the age of seven. After the age of seven, the father de facto becomes the guardian of the child.
Right.
You know, and so basically the woman's rights as a mother, you know, in a divorce case become irrelevant. And what we've had in Britain, you see, a few years back, people thought that Sharia courts were just little eccentricities, and nobody really did much about them. But we didn't know how many there were. There were a few, you know, we thought five, maybe 20 even, you know. And then just a couple of years ago, it was revealed that for several years now, we have been in Britain having Sharia law by the back door, specifically through this idea of courts allowing negotiations to go on, arbitration to be performed under the aegis of a local Sharia court. If both parties in a divorce case or an issue of inheritance, if the parties agree to it, then the Sharia court's decision becomes final and there are no rights of appeal or redress because they have signed their rights away.
Mm-hmm.
You can't, when you've allowed arbitration to go in, you can't then go, you have to then countersue and start all over again because there's no appeals process for that sort of thing. If a genuine legal decision has been made which is wrong, you were allowed to appeal it. But once you've agreed to take arbitration from a third party who is not part of the court system, you've thrown away your rights, and there are a lot of women who are now complaining because they've agreed to issues of Sharia court judges to decide over their divorces and who looks after their kids and how much money they get. A wife in Islam is only allowed, after her husband has divorced her, she's only allowed what he will allow her and what the local imam will allow her. There aren't set rights to say, okay, we divide the family, you know, home in half. There are none of those rights, none of those protections, and now we have in Britain 120 different Sharia courts, at least, who are arbitrating
That's a little bit different than what we're facing. I mean, basically,
what I'm trying to say to you is
you're talking about parallel courts.
Yeah, but the thing is, what you were talking about was introducing Sharia law via finance and via family law courts. And what I was trying to say there and was that very specifically, now they are realizing that these things are an abuse of power.
Oh, there's no doubt. I mean, if you look what they were trying to do up in New York, they were trying to follow suit with what was going on in England and trying to advocate for parallel court systems in the Muslim communities. That was pretty much chopped down over the course of 2007 through 2009. And then they started to push the family law process into the court system of the United States so that they could blend the cultures. And, you know, it came to the point where over the course of 23 different states that were put inside a Yerushalmi study that was about 600 pages long of appellate briefs, he found a number, about 50 different cases where Sharia law was the deciding factor. So what happened was he was about to release that report in May, and the ACLU got wind of it. And whenever they got wind of it, at that point, the head of the religion department of the ACLU and the head of the human rights division at the ACLU up in New York, I think the guy's name's Daniel Mock, the main one, they actually put in at the Huffington Post an article called Anti-Sharia Law, A Solution Looking for a Problem, where they basically come out and say, there is no problem whatsoever with Sharia law, and they continue the denial that this is even a problem. So they've denied the problem. The Center for American Progress has tried to discredit what's going on with Yerushalmi. They've been lined up against with ADL. The George Soros group actually has a member as far as the ACLU is concerned on the board of directors at the Center for American Progress. So everything that was going on at Center for American Progress, the ACLU knew. And at this point, they coordinated an attack against Yerushalmi again before he had a chance to release this document. He released it. Jihad Inc. and a number of different places, Robert Spencer's place and the Center for Security Policy discussed it and released the information. And it was, like I said, it was about 650 pages worth of information. But I tell you, you should read the first 75 pages. It's worthwhile.
And, right, well, send me a link. And maybe if you've got a link available, put it on the chat room too so that everybody else can have a chance to read it.
You can actually go to my first blog post, my first live blog post over at my website, and I actually discuss it. And
well, can you give a link and then put that on the chat room?
Absolutely. I'll do that in just a little bit.
Well, I'm going to have another music break soon in about 10 minutes. So when that happens, maybe you can go ferreting around and finding it and putting it on the chat room.
Okay. Well, basically after that, a guy named Jalay, an attorney down in Louisiana, he was working with these courts that were trying to figure out what was going on with Sharia. He released a stunning, you know, rebuke of this article, and it's over at American Thinker. It's definitely worth reading. And once he did that, at that point, everything went silent for about a month. And then, after about a month and a half or so, the New York Times picked up, and a lady, Andrea Elliott, came out and did a just a thrash job of a hit piece on Yaroshelmi and discussed his wages, how his program through SANE and Mapping Sharia worked, how much the funding was. And once we saw that in July, we should have gotten an inkling that, you know, something's going on. They're actually looking into the funding. But, I mean, we do that all the time anyway. We're used to doing investigative research. So it didn't really shock us that much to find out, ooh, you know, wow, there was actually somebody got paid for doing some research. Who knew?
What I would like to do, I don't want to cut you too much, but, I mean, we are running a little bit low on time. Now, what I want to do is have a little quick break, not for music, but I want to have Wajahat Ali's discussion with Al Jazeera. And I did try very hard to get him and Tim Murphy speaking. Actually, Tim Murphy does squeak. He doesn't speak. I don't think he's capable of actually speaking. He's just like one of those big soft toys that you poke their tummies and they make these ee-ee sounds. Sorry. That's being very un-Buddhist of me. But I'm going to play... This is... This came out in the last week. Some people in the chat room may already have heard this. It's 3 minutes long, and this is where Wajahat Ali is explaining what he believes the document is about, this 160-page document, you know, called Fear, Inc. Now, I'm just going to play it now.
All right. I went ahead and put that thing in the...
Wajahat Ali is the lead writer and researcher of the Center for American Progress Islamophobia Report. I asked him, who are the individuals generating the false facts used by politicians, grassroots groups, and the media?
The money primarily goes to what I call the central nervous system of the Islamophobia Network, the Islamophobia Scholars and Policy Experts. They're a group of five individuals who have think tanks. The names are Frank Gaffney in the Center for Security Policy, David Yerushalmi in SANE. We also have Daniel Pipes in the Middle East Forum. We have Steve Emerson and the Investigative Project on Terrorism, and Robert Spencer with his blog Jihad Watch, and he's the co-founder of the hate group Stop Islamization of America.
And these organizations and these groups, who exactly are they targeting here in the United States with their vitriol? Because, you know, are they targeting mosques? Are they targeting religious leaders? And I asked that question also because, you know, you'd remember during the election campaign in 2007, there were these sort of accusations made against then-candidate Obama, saying that he's a secret Muslim, as if that was some kind of crime of some sort, you know. So who are they targeting?
Muslim is the boogeyman of the 21st century for the Islamophobia Network, and they've realized that by exploiting existing fears, ignorance, and uncertainty against Muslims and Islam, they can profit, number one, and they can protect their anti-Muslim extremist ideologies under this guise of fighting so-called radicalization and radical Islam. Specifically, I think this story is a repeat. This has happened before to Japanese Americans, Jews, and Irish Catholics. Right now it happens to be Muslim Americans. And what was once fringe extremist rhetoric, unfortunately, has been mainstreamed due to the volatile climate that we live in. And because this network is so tight, so connected, and is able to mainstream these messages, thanks to the media and thanks to, as you said, political players.
Do you believe that this report will get widespread dissemination, will generate the kind of discussion and debate that you're looking for?
Definitely. I do believe it. It was written for a mainstream audience, not to be trapped in the DC cocoon. And already we've seen that it's gone viral. And it's specifically, it's supposed to empower Americans, inoculate them, really, from this misinformation, fear, and bigotry. So when they see these people, they expose them for what they are. Not legitimate scholars, not neutral experts, but, you know, hate mongers, fear mongers with an agenda which is anti-Muslim and divides Americans along religious lines, which is fundamentally un-American.
At the end of it all, I mean, how do you hope? What's the best case scenario to counter this?
The best case scenario, again, is this is a fact-based investigative report. We have evidence here. And specifically, the evidence will, like I said, empower Americans with knowledge and make them realize, oh, wait, these people who we see on Fox News and we see on mainstream outlets, why are we listening to them? We don't listen to the Ku Klux Klan. We don't give them the megaphone. Why are we listening to anti-Muslim bigots? We didn't know their agenda. Now we do. So we've exposed them. And as responsible citizens, we marginalize them. So we can move this country again towards moderate moderation and civil discourse.
Wow. Right. Now, I mean, this is something which he has mentioned several times about marginalizing, and which basically means silencing people he does not like. If you silence people you don't like, you don't have civil discourse. You have a shutdown of discourse. Now, we got Holger on the air. Now, if you can just wait a minute, Gary, and then Holger's got a quote that we were talking about Turkey earlier. So let's bring Holger back on, and I'm pressing his little button. Here he is. Can you hear me now, Holger?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
I can hear you very clearly.
Well, you're familiar with the term when hell freezes over?
Yes.
Okay. Some people would use that term when they're talking about me standing up and applauding a Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
But I am going to do that right now. I'm standing and I'm applauding a Democrat because today he said, quote, "Turkey should be ashamed of itself. In an almost unbelievable act of hypocrisy, the Syrian ambassador sits comfortably in Ankara while the Assad regime kills more than 2,000 of its own people, but Turkey has expelled the Israeli ambassador for Israel's proper enforcement of a legally established blockade. Rather than bashing the only real democracy in the Middle East, Turkey should focus on its own problems, such as ending its occupation of Cyprus once and for all." That was U.S. Congressman Elliot Engel, Democrat from New York.
Well, congratulations to him.
I wanted to send my love out to Representative Engel. That's all I got. Yeah. Thanks, guys.
Well, that's really good. Thanks, Holger. That's,
you bet.
That's a good quote, and it's very, very valid. I mean, you know, it is obvious with Turkey expelling the Israeli ambassador that, you know, all for the sake of the incident on May the 31st last year, you know, it's a very, very bad move for them to make.
Well, let's just hope that more and more congressmen follow suit and that this gets to be an uproar and so forth, because we need to let countries like Turkey know that if they decide to go down this path, that that they're going to pay a price. So
yes.
Anyway, thanks again for letting me pop back in.
That's no problem at all.
Right,
anytime you can call back in anytime you want. Okay, thanks, Holger. Cheers. Okay, Gary, are you there?
I am.
Great, sorry. Okay, so I played that little bit now, and I was saying about how it's been a mantra that he has used a lot about talking about marginalizing people.
Right.
And I think, you know, he is succeeding. I mean, he was saying he wants it to go viral. He doesn't want it to be stuck in the DC cocoon. And it's certainly gone viral. I read earlier on from Zaman, which is a very widely read Turkish newspaper, where they were misrepresenting, taking the false facts, which were in the document, and presenting them up front. I mean, I think it's a confection. I think it's a really bad piece of cheap propaganda. But, and I also think the timing is wrong because
it creates talking points. What it does is it basically states the people of the conservative movements, either the Tea Party or the anti-jihad or anti-Sharia or pro-Israel, those movements, they are right-wing extremist ideologues. When what is necessary is for us to have the better ideas and not be so rigid in our ideology and so extreme.
Yeah, but Gary, if it was just about ideas, if it was just about ideas, it wouldn't be a problem. What I find is this is a hatchet attack. This is not a fair attack. I mean, if they have legitimate ideas, they should present them. What they are doing is falsely
You don't know Democrats in America well.
No, I know leftists. Hey, Gary, come on. You know, be realistic. You know, I've been writing in this business for quite a few years now. I do know pretty much, you know, what their agendas are, and it's very little different from leftists around the world. But, you know, it's always a case of, for the left, they We used to have a saying in Britain back in the 70s, give no platform to fascists. And the thing is, a fascist can be anyone and anything you choose to label as a fascist. And what that does, it sets the agenda. The only people who were allowed a legitimate voice must be from the left. And I think these are the aspects of Wajahat Ali's discussions, which I find the most disturbing. He presents a load of half-truths and baloney and badly researched facts. He's hypocritical. He's saying that these groups of people who make $46 million over 10 years between five different groups, whereas his own organization makes $25 million in 1 year. And then, you know, in 2 years, it's made more than the five groups have made over an entire decade. You know, it's hypocrisy. It is wrong. He's falsely claiming from the outset that these people are deliberately anti-Muslim. And the thing is, the timing. This is coming up right before September the 11th, 10th anniversary. And this is what I find very, very disturbing. He is suggesting that Islamophobia is being created by these five people. And if we get rid of these five people, I mean, he would have had a great job being in the French Revolution under Robespierre, you know, when the terror began, when they first, the Girondins, and then, you know, Danton's followers would all end up with their heads being sliced off. And as soon as one group of people were exterminated, then the next group of people, all right, the church, let's go and chop all their heads off. This is what I find really awful about proscription. He's trying to name five individuals for being responsible for all of the Islamophobia in America and in the West by deference, because they wouldn't be mentioning Anders Behring Breivik if they weren't going to try and expand it to say, look, these are the consequences. They're trying to create a false causality between the writings of people like Steve Emerson. What the hell has Steve Emerson done wrong, other than document what's actually going on in the jihad networks, within the mosques, within the education establishments, where people like in California told people they must not cooperate with police. Ingrid Mattson of ISNA, she's Ignis, saying to people that no, you can't. No, Islamic Society of North America. She was saying to people that you mustn't cooperate with the FBI or allow them into mosques because they are the enemy. You know, these are people care who support Hamas, and now you've got the Holy Land Foundation trial. Just today, the news is coming out. Their lawyers are going to then try and overturn the convictions against all of the defendants. This is all coming up before the anniversary of 9/11. If there is anything, any single thing that has made Americans Islamophobic, take out the fact that 148 embassy staff were kidnapped from the American embassy in Tehran in Iran in 1979 and kept for more than a year as hostages, beaten, tortured, threatened with having their relatives killed. Forget all that. Forget about how America has been demonized in the Muslim world as the great Satan. Just think of the 2,977 innocent people who were murdered on 9/11. That is where the source of American Islamophobia is coming from. And these devious, dishonest, mental midgets like Wajahat Ali and his little friends think that they can give this idea of, if you just remove these five critics of Islam, everything will be hunky-dory. It'll be like one blinking, bleeding Benetton advert where everybody's going to hold hands like in those damn Coca-Cola commercials. You know, I'd like to teach the world to sing. Wearing your caftans on a hill, like, you know, with a wind blowing through your hair, with a multicultured rainbow coalition of lesbians and transsexuals and friends of Tim Murphy all getting together with the heterosexuals and saying, you know, I'd like to build a world of peace and harmony. Bollocks! It's not going to happen. Sorry. I ranted a little bit there. Sorry.
Well, I mean, you have to, you kind of have to look at what they're trying to accomplish as far as shaping the narrative, and just say the Islamophobia Observatory over at the OIC has been putting out a report for the last 5 years, and they've been having a number of different organizations actively pushing activities at the, I think it's called the OECS, the European organization that is working with a number of different Muslim outfits. And whenever you see what they're trying to do, they're actually trying to say, we have to have legislation to make sure that there is that Islamophobia is removed from all of the walks of Europe. And they're trying to do the same thing over here that they're doing in Europe right now as far as over-accommodating Islam. And they're completely shaping the dialogue to go that way. I mean, that's basically what I see happening. As far as, I mean, you're right. They are fallacious arguments that they make completely. There is not one note of truth in it. I mean,
but because they're presented emotionally and emotively, I mean, the one thing I always tell my writers in Family Security Matters, always take, I mean, having just gone on an emotive rant there, where anybody listening who doesn't go, oh, look, it's a right-wing bigot, you know what I mean? He's in full flow, you know, the bigots are like, you know, flowing out. I mean, the thing is, I really find it insulting that when you hear Wajahat Ali talking as he did on the Blogging Heads interview that he did with Tim Murphy that you have on your website, that interview where he's saying that it's dollars are what motivates people. I have been writing on Islamism from 2005, you know, from a week after the bombings of in London. I have been writing, and I've only been paid a minimum wage for the last year for writing about Islam. I would carry on writing whether I was being paid or not. And it is insulting to all the bloggers. You know, people like Holger, you know, he's got his blog. The other people on this site who've got their blogs, they don't do that for money. They do it because they believe in it. They believe in freedom. They believe in the freedom of a democracy where you do not have a 7th century barbarian sexist cult taking over your democratic rights. And that is what we have had in Britain in the name. Who did that?
Well, I mean, you were talking earlier about the fact that they had $25 million a year. Well, the fact is, they actually probably have closer to $50 million.
Well, yeah, no, but there's 25 million that we know about from just one source, you know.
Well, they have about 300 different employees and fellows and scholars that work there. So what you're looking at is an average salary of about $60,000 to $100,000 for all of those people. And what Wajahat Ali doesn't understand is that we are not doing it necessarily with any pay whatsoever. And he can't comprehend that's happening. So the reason he's going after the money is because he figures, well, if we can stop the main voices, then we will have complete dominance on the airwaves. But the fact is, we haven't really been competing. We haven't been offering a counter-influence movement against the left, against Islamic radicalism and the movements that Wahhabism has been making. The entire anti-jihad community and Tea Party community has never, ever put the effort together overall to coalesce around a leadership organization or any other type of research movement. Even though we could get 20 to 50 people together and actually unlock all the secrets of Islamic supremacy, Islamic finance, we could actually figure out what's going on and map what's going on as far as lobbyists are concerned and who are working with the countries that are Islamic. We could actually do that if we had the money, because we would be able to stop what we were doing and actually get to work. But nothing has happened like that in the anti-jihad community. And I've been for the last 2 years yelling about it because I have been working for 5 years without any pay. And yes. I really would like to continue going on and actually have somebody stroke me a check and have a salary to where I can work 12 hours a day on this thing and actually do some good,
yes.
you know, and not have anything to worry about and be able to go to the dentist without having to, you know, do all sorts of
things.
That's crazy
where people like George Soros are so morally reprehensible and are virtually criminal in what they are doing, because he's funding bullcrap. You know, he's funding people who are going to work against traditional American interests. Now, you know, okay, I'm British, but the thing is, we have only come through two world wars because we had American help. We're not going to get any help next time, you know, I don't think. But we need America to stay intact. We need America. The whole free world needs America to stay intact. Israel needs America to stay intact. And if you've got these subversives like Soros and these various, you know, the idiots who write and work for the Center for American Progress and for J Street and these, you know, the ACLU, the Southern Poverty Law Center, all these other leftist groups who are undermining the status quo, trying to usurp it and replace it with a European-style collectivism. You are going to kill America. You're going to kill the thing. It's like the, you know, the goose that lays the golden eggs. You have already got your own president undermining everything that is about what makes America great. And I don't know. I get very, very upset about this. You know, I think people should be paid money for what they do. But the thing is, when you do write for free, you end up getting attacked. There are groups run mainly from Britain, you know, this guy called David Miller from Strathclyde University, who has links with Australia and America, you know, websites like Powerbase, Spinwatch, and other groups like that. They were all part of the same collectivist group, which is blacklisting anybody who writes against Islam and demonizing them as potential fascists. And this document, it's an appalling document. It is no big deal. If people are funding anti-jihad material, they are doing it because it is basically, they are fearful of what jihad in all its forms, be it in its aggressive form or in its political form, what that is going to actually cause as a consequence. Now, what's this Maltese saying? Spencer goes all over the world speaking about jihad. He could be killed at any of his appearances. Yes, that is a part. I spoke to, in 2009, I spoke to Robert Spencer, and he was saying that he has to have bodyguards on several of the occasions when he goes out. They cost money. Some of us who blog don't have any of those protections. And, you know, we think, you know, we've got to have some sort of protection. I had a cyber stalker a while back, and when I got the police in, they saw that I was writing for a blog called Western Resistance, and they say, resistance against what? And I was told by this policeman that, you know, well, we've come here to investigate a crime, but, you know, I don't want to go away and find that we've got to investigate you. Telling me that because I was writing about political Islam, I was told, what qualification did I have? This is exactly what's happening with these people in the wretched Center for American Progress, saying you don't have a qualification in Islam, therefore you've got, even though you've been beaten up and you've been vilified, as Noni Darwish has, that you have got no right to have a say about Islam. I mean, do
you
have to be
training?
Yeah, I mean, that's ridiculous. I mean, if you just live in a society and you see that all of a sudden your kid, you know, starts off eating normal meat, but then after so many kids in the school are all Muslim, all of a sudden the meat that he eats is then halal meat, you can see something is happening there that is not what you brought up in the country expected. Things are changing because of the intransigence of the Islamist representatives and the useful idiots who appease them at every step of the way. Europe has lost its cojones. It's lost its sense of integrity. It's down on its knees. In the name of multiculturalism, it's swapped everything that was good about Europe, its independence, for this sort of mishmash of multiculturalism where I'm meant to think and feel exactly the same as somebody from Hungary or Czechoslovakia? No, and I wouldn't want to. I like people from Czechoslovakia and Hungary and Poland, but I like them because they're different. You know, you can't make all these people sort of become one great big homogeneous society where everybody's going to speak the same language politically. The variety, the diversity of life is what makes people strong. And America, under the name of diversity now, is following Europe, where diversity in the form of multiculturalism is all about weakening societies. And this is something, you know, this is making me... I'm going to have a very quick break, a little bit of music, because I'm about to blow a gasket, honey. Sorry. I'm going to put something very... very, very quick on, if I can find Alligator Crawl, which I probably won't be able to find, and then I'll calm down and I will, we'll just have a few more minutes left of the show. But it is upsetting to see things like honesty and truth are being thrown out of the window for the sake of political correctness. Finally, I've got it. Bit of music now. Okay, Gary, now the platform is yours. You just take it away. Whatever you want to say about this Islamophobia Fear Inc. report, which is produced by the Center for American Policy at Progress.
Well, about halfway through my discussion on the part two of my blog, I had a little a ditty that I wanted to just kind of bring forward. I said... I was discussing the anti-Sharia movement and the possibility of coalescing around a counter-influence movement. And I stated that it must be made clear that we, the anti-Sharia movement, are declaring war on the Ayatollah of Iran. We are declaring war on the president of Iran and any other country who seeks Israel's destruction. We are declaring war on Syed Hassan Nasrallah and his Hezbollah. We are declaring war on Muqtada al-Sadr in Iraq for his crimes against our troops. We are declaring war against the established ideologues of the Muslim Brotherhood and their Palestinian patsies. We are declaring war on the Wahhabis of the Diobandi. We are at war with the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and other Salafists of the militant Hizbut Tahrir mold that rally to their black banners. We are declaring war on Islamic finance, economic jihad, dawahs, charitable zakat zakiyah, and its terrorist financing. We are declaring war on the idea of submission and dimitude. We will not kneel to Islam's radical program of totalitarianism that is evident in its hunt for freedom the world over, with nearing 18,000 terrorist strikes since 9/11. We are declaring war by doing one thing, rising and declaring our independence from the tyranny of Sharia and the Islamic supremacy. And it needs to be stated very clearly to those on the left that we do not hate Muslims. We hate tyranny. To hate tyranny is to love liberty. And if you have a problem with that, get out of the way, or we will declare cultural war on you as an enemy of liberty. You will be tarred and feathered with our pins and our voices as we shout you down. Islamic supremacy is not an imagined threat. The leaders of the Islamic supremacist mold are spouting their hatred of humanity every day. And while you attempt to interpret their hatred as peace, we take the slavers at their word.
Gary, that's very Islamophobic. You should feel ashamed of yourself, you know? Go and sit in the corner and whip yourself into submission, you know, because that's what Islam is, submission. Yeah, I mean, this is the awful thing. I mean, you're right. It's actually what has happened is that the people are trying to say that an ideology that was founded in bloodshed and war by a child-molesting, illiterate camel herder and caravan raider is basically something that you now cannot insult in any way, shape, or form. I mean, you know, I'm sorry, but if Muhammad, the so-called prophet, had sex with a 9-year-old kid, which he did, he's a disgusting piece of crap. And you should be allowed to say that, but you can't even say that, because if you do it, you're a hater. And you're anti-Muslim. And it's not about anti-Muslim. It's about these poor people are then indoctrinated to think he is the most perfect man who ever lived, and not to question what he was really about. Whatever he was really about, it was not something that was about democracy and the Constitution and kumbaya and sitting on a hilltop with a bottle of Coca-Cola, wearing a caftan and wanting to teach the world to sing in perfect harmony. I mean, it really is something that... It upsets me immensely that the whole compass that we have been brought up to believe in of where right and wrong stands has been turned on its head. Christianity has been insulted from, I mean, I'm 53 years old, I'm an old man. But I remember Christianity being insulted when I was, you know, a kid. Nobody was being prosecuted for it. Now you cannot say anything bad about Islam without being labeled as a hater and a troublemaker. I've got somebody who's trying to Skype me now. So
Well, I think it's pretty easy to just, you know, speak your mind on the topic. The main thing that people need to realize, though, is that this is a war, and it's a war against tyranny, not against Muslims.
Yeah,
and I mean, we've been fighting that war since the founding of our country, and we're not going to ever stop, and we know that. But the thing is, the people of this Fear Inc. report have basically stated that people like Frank Gaffney are unhinged because he didn't have the ability to fight the boogeyman of Russia and the Soviet Russia threat anymore, so he had to invent a new one.
Right.
I mean, they're actually stating that, you know, Frank Gaffney invented this totalitarianist ideology, you know, which is amazing. I mean, he's got 1,400 years worth of material that he's created, you know, by himself. I thought that was pretty impressive.
It's just so upsetting is that, you know, a few people, I mean, I'm sorry, but I mean, Wajahat Ali, if he is the main author and the main researcher of this report, I mean, he seems like an intellectual lightweight to me. And this is what worries me, is that what he is doing is he's like somebody who's going into a room full of glass sculpture with a hammer and is just smashing it all up. And what will be left at the end will not be recognizable if people like him inherit the earth and inherit the main political discourse that he wants to sort of be part of. He should not be setting the agenda. We've only got 60 seconds left till the end of the show. We'll probably carry on talking for a few minutes afterwards, for about 5 or 10 minutes after the show ends. I want to say thank you to my special guest, Gary H. Johnson Jr. You can find all of his writings on the Tea Party Tribune. He has a section called The Bunker there. For the last 2 days, he's been doing an all-day blog on this report, the Fear Inc. report from the Center for American Progress. I want to thank Reese Cup, my co-host. I want to thank Holger for calling in twice and giving us good information and a good bit of discourse going. And we are coming very, very close to the end of the show. Thank you very much for listening, and please come back next week on Blog Talk Radio's Global Security Matters. I've been Adrian Morgan. Thank you very much indeed. Talk to you next week. And I think that is it. Yep. Hello, Gary. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Cool. Is Reese there? Reese, talk to me. Talk to me, Reese. Don't leave us out of it. Poor Reese. Oh, hi, Reese.
I'm here.
Yeah, well, did you have any trolls in the chat room?
We had a couple. We had an interesting phone call, and that was that.
An interesting phone call?
Yeah.
Interesting enough to talk about now, or do you want to, like, you know, email me later and tell me all about it?
Oh, no, it's like eye-rolling stupid, you know, it's just a troll. Just, you know, they played raunchy music and hung up.
Oh, well. I didn't play any sleazy music. I think I'm going to have to play us out on some sleaze.
Yeah, the stuff he played wasn't your fun sleaze. It was just stupid. So.
I'm glad to see, you know, Morty was there as well. You know, he's cool.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's been an interesting show. I mean, I just think it's very worrying that, you know, it just seems... when everybody should be remembering what 9/11 was all about,
yeah,
about Islamic terrorists, you know, who were motivated by Islam, murdered 2,977 innocent people in America, on American soil, without having declared open warfare. You know, I think, you know, with something like that coming up, and then to have this wretched document thrown out into the public arena, and to have all of the publicity going to this measly little cockweasel. Can I say cockweasel?
I think so. It's your show.
I think so.
Yeah, okay. This miserable...
it's a rooster and a weasel. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, except for he's a very shriveled little one. Sorry.
Yeah. It's a banty. Yeah. Okay.
Well, I think it's amazing just looking at all this stuff. How many links there are to DLA Piper, George Mitchell, Georgetown itself.
Right.
There's and Harvard. There's so many different pieces of this puzzle moving. And each time I've only done two of the players, but now I've see how it's, you know, connected with the Century Fund Foundation. How it's connected with a number of different units that are working out there to actively affect what's going on in Afghanistan. The Middle East Progress page, they're actually connected through a number of different organizations like the Cohen Brothers and stuff like that, the Cohen Group. I mean, there's so many different interconnected pieces of this of this puzzle, that whenever you see the reason that it's going viral is because he has a network of these people who he's shooting it out to, and they all have emails, and they've got 300 who know 300 who know 300, and that's how it's expanding across the country. And they're all based on diplomacy. You know, that's they're connected with the USAID and State Department. So everything that's going on with Center for American Progress is based on dialogue and development and diplomacy. Mm. So they are literally trying to shape this dialogue and trying to change the entire scope of the discussion for the next 10 years. You can see that's what they're doing, and it's not going to work, but they're going to try.
Of course it won't work, but what annoys me is the way that the media is so supine, and it's so pliable in their little sticky fingers, you know, that they can prod, and then everything will flow along the way that they're doing it. I mean, you know, that thing that I played earlier on from Al Jazeera where he said he was hoping it was going to go viral, and it has, exactly as predicted. And it's like, and you think, who the hell is Wajahat Ali? Who is he? He's an attorney, big deal. You know,
yeah,
he's an attorney.
But he's saying what they want to hear, man. You know, sort of like Obama. He said, you know, it's going to hope and change. Everybody says,
yeah, well,
really,
what
we'll
hope and change has he brought in? He's brought in two damned illegal immigrant relatives, you know, who are basically, you know. I mean,
that's how our media system works here. For some reason, I mean, they have decided that that's how they want the dialogue to be. And people in the anti-jihad movement talk about complicated subjects like takfir and, you know, fatah and stuff like that. And they would actually have to open a book and maybe do some research to understand what they're saying. So the easiest thing to do is just to say, well, they haven't, you know, they don't speak Arabic, or they haven't been formally trained in Islam, so they have no clue what they're saying. They're not professionals at all. We can just discredit them.
It's such a dishonest way of arguing. It really is dishonest. I mean, you know, basically, you know, if somebody is victimized, I mean, we have in Britain, you know, and you're having it in America, of a rise in anti-Semitic attacks against Jewish people, and the rise is not being created by right-wing extremists. It's being carried out by Muslims who are attacking Jewish people because they see them as responsible for Israel and Israel's oppression of their Palestinian brothers in Islam.
Well,
I mean,
I'd like to see if the Southern Poverty Law Center, which is talking about these right-wing extremist hate groups and everything, I'd like to see if they have gotten some more funding from either George Soros or from the federal government.
If they have got the guts to stand up and actually to condemn the Islamic hate. You know, Islamists. And
they have a number of hate groups listed as far as like black Muslims and hate groups as far as black stuff. As far as their thing, they're saying that there's over 900 hate groups in America. And the anti-jihadist groups are just one of those sets. And they're about to add the Tea Party to that set. And what they do is they advance the narrative. It's sort of like, oh, the Tea Partiers are terrorists. And they advance the narrative and they say it over and over and over. And sooner or later when they say it, it'll stick.
Whenever we have the Tea Party gets mentioned in Britain, when you get these stupid left-wing comedians, they basically portray the Tea Party members as lunatics, frothing, gun-toting, neo-fascist lunatics of the far right, even though fascism is a left-wing ideology. Mm-hmm. And they get massive cheers of sort of recognition because the people in the audience have heard all of this pap thrown at them, and that's what they want to believe. They want to believe that these people are mad or insane or racist or, you know, religious bigots or haters. And, you know, this is what really, really annoys me is that the agenda is given to these people who have absolutely no respect for other people's opinions. You know, and you get on, you know, the media, all you see are the people from the left. You know, in America, they're still, you know, pretty much in the middle. In Britain and Europe, it's gone to the far left, who are then getting most of the exposure. You know,
well,
and I'm...
To me, like, That's what they're doing. They're, as far as their concept of what marginalization means or isolating means, it literally means, like you were talking about before, you know, if it's not for the left, then it's not allowed to be discussed.
Yes.
So that's basically what is happening. You know, if they have their talking points, and if anybody tries to go against them, they just say, oh, well, they have no credibility whatsoever. I mean, they're not a scholar. You know, and
yeah.
People will believe that because the person who is speaking in terms that the audience isn't used to hearing, instead of looking and saying, you know, I need to look that term up, they then turn and this guy says, well, he's not really a scholar. And they say, good thing I don't have to look that up.
Yeah, but the thing is, it's, you know, there is an agenda that's been going on in universities around the world from the early 1960s. You know, when you had the NSA, it was founded in 1963. In 1965, you had the Federation of Student Islamic Societies in Britain. All of these are connected with the Muslim Brotherhood and this idea of, you know, and in that early 60s period, King Fahd of Saudi Arabia was giving out huge amounts of money to the Muslim Brotherhood and affiliated groups to do dawah and missionary work, to infiltrate into university establishments, to infiltrate into political establishments wherever possible in the West.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very interesting that in a country like Saudi Arabia, that, you know, it's still, because at Georgetown University, where most of these people, like that little cockweasel, apparently has, you know, graduated from, you know, Georgetown University, where you've got John Esposito runs the Center for American Islamic Understanding. That is the Prince Al-Walid bin Talal Center for Islamic Understanding. You know, and so you still have the Saudis are setting the agenda in the outside world, even though they wouldn't allow the same to happen to them. They wouldn't allow Christian people to start having a center for Christian Islamic understanding in, say, Riyadh or in Mecca. That would be banned. You know, and it's interesting that, you know, why Islam is so insistent upon keeping itself free from the pollution of subversion and other ideas. And yet, what we're seeing in the West is because we've opened ourselves up to intolerant ideologies. We've seen ourselves opening up our goodwill to representatives from countries which have absolutely no freedom of speech for anybody who thinks differently to the Islamist outlook. We are putting ourselves in America and Europe and Britain and Australia and any other Western country, you know, and I would include South American countries, you know, like, I mean, Hezbollah has been, you know, in existence in Argentina for years, you know, 3 decades. You know, we have got a real problem in the West of our tolerance, our wanting to be understanding, our wanting to embrace everything, means that we're embracing the same vipers who will stab us in our heart with their teeth. And we have been doing it for so long, we don't know any different. Wajahat Ali and his little friends, they're all wet behind the ear. Not one of them seems to be over 30. They haven't got any clue on life. You have jaded, cynical old tosspots like George Soros throwing money at them. I don't know what, you know, why he does it, but he does it. You know,
well,
he can
again, if you get 5 or 6 people saying something, you know, and you give them the platform and you give them the abilities and the wherewithal to get in front of people over and over and over, then you can do the process of marginalizing. I mean, that's what George Soros has the power to do, to make sure. I mean, they started what on Current TV, and now they're moving in. They went over to Al Jazeera TV. And then once they did
and then
that,
Obama's
that point,
encouraging that. You know, he's been encouraging, and now you have in New York, you've got Al Jazeera on cable. You know, it's and free. It doesn't even have to be paid for. They get it for free.
Wow.
You know, I mean, which is what I think, you know, we've really got problems going on in the West of, you know, people are making themselves submissive to Islam. You know, and I'm not saying Islamism here. I'm saying Islam, and I do see Islam as a threat because it has been given special status that you can't criticize it.
Yeah,
it's a status which the natural religions of the countries in which Islam is encroaching upon, for example, Christianity, there are no such protections for Christianity in these countries, which are ostensibly Christian. And this is where there is something incredibly wrong. Why should Islam have special privilege, status? And I think, you know, what we're doing with the new media, that's what thwarts so many of these people. You know, it is through the new media. I mean, okay, they've had Fox News, but then again, they've got Prince Al-Waleed bin Talal is going to, you know, he's the majority shareholder as soon as Rupert Murdoch butts out. So you won't have any more right-wing nonsense on Fox. You know, you might get that's all going to go. So, you know, the mainstream media is going to have isolated everybody. But while the internet remains uncontrolled, and that's one thing Obama wants to do. He wants to control the media.
Mm-hmm. It seems you like they're doing everything they can to silence the message, and they've got to cut out the money because they believe that the money's what drives it, and it really bothers them that it's spreading. Comparatively, they have to spend $50 million in 2 years.
Yeah, what annoys me is that these people aren't even using facts. They're suppressing opinions they don't like, when what those opinions are actual facts. They're not just some empty-headed, bigoted, I don't like Muslims act. It's nothing to do with that. They are having to manufacture and twist everything around to say that people who are anti-Islam and anti-Islamism are anti-Muslim. I mean, that whole thing about Christianity. What does the Christians say? Hate the sin, love the sinner. You know? If Christians can have that double standard, why can't we be allowed that privilege of being able to say, well, we don't like Islamism, but we're not against Muslims? You know? We're not allowed that, right? We are demonized.
Islam has become a protected class here.
Well, it's everywhere. It's a protected class. And once you do that, you allow Sharia law, you have an unequal society. And you've got to have, everybody should be equal under the law. Man, woman, Christian, Muslim, atheist, Buddhist, pagan, everybody should be treated with the same legitimate basic rights. I don't know. I'm very cross about this.
It was a fun show.
Yeah, I think it's time to call it quits. I've got a friend from Australia who's been, you know, trying to get me in touch with him. You know.
Yeah, I've got to watch a pressing video. It's called The Philanthropy of George Soros. You know.
Yes.
I'm definitely getting ready for the next round, right. So it's going to be fun. I hope you have a chance to check me out tomorrow. I know it's a holiday weekend here. I don't know if it is over there.
No, we had our holiday weekend last weekend, and I was working all the way through it, so I didn't get my holiday last weekend. And, Reese, remember not to wear white shoes on Labor Day.
I think she's left.
Has Reese left the room?
I think she took off.
Oh, Reese, you didn't. She did.
No, I'm here. I had to get going because I've got to get things going.
Okay, babes. All right. So we're going to call this. I'm going to close this all down. I'm not even going to play any music. I mean, thank you very much, anybody who's carried on listening. Thank you, Rusika, for keeping the chat room under control and getting rid of the trolls for us.
I didn't do anything. They just disappeared on their own.
Definitely. You have a good one, Reese. Don't break
Gary,
too much stuff. I'll send you some more tweets whenever I get this stuff on the road.
I appreciate it. I do get over there when I have time. I just pop over there and just go through them as I have time. So, yeah, please do tweet me. I love it. Thank you.
All right. Well, y'all have a good night.
Well, thank you very much. That was our guest, Gary H. Johnson, Jr. You can find his writings on the Tea Party Tribune. And thank you to Reese Cup, full of peanut butter goodness, who is not going to be wearing white shoes after this weekend. Are you, Reese?
I don't have white shoes. No, I don't wear white shoes anyway.
If you hung around with your chickens long enough, you would have white shoes. Sorry.
That's wrong.
I know, wrong on so many levels. Okay. But thanks very much. And thank you for anybody who's still been listening on the recorded version of the show. Thank you very much. I'm going to end the show now. I'm not going to deal with any more music. I've been Adrian Morgan. I'm the editor of Family Security Matters. This has been Global Security Matters on the Radio Jihad Network on Blog Talk Radio. And do you want to say goodbye, Reese?
Good night, Reese.
All right. Good night, Reese, too. You take care, everybody. And we'll see you next week on Friday, the 9th of September. Thank you very much. This will be very close to the 9/11 anniversary, so we'll have some special music and some special subjects then. Thank you very much indeed. Good night.